Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics and government went wrong and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight aimed at making us and government more responsible. If you have a question or insight, call us toll-free to, from the United States, 1-877-876-5227. From Canada, 888-810-8322. Or call us direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may be also able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if an old-fashioned on-the-air station in your area carries this show, just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as is humanly possible on the station archives. And you can read my own blog at http://howtheneoconsstolefreedom.blogspot.com. On our last show, we heard from John Kaldewieler, the inventor from New York who is about to launch a revolutionary energy source that will put your local electric company out of business. It sounds impossible to you today, but it isn't any more impossible than honesty in politics. I bet you think that's impossible, too. Nope. Not any more impossible than an honest plumber or putting a man on the moon. Every one of the things we think are impossible seems so because of the problems that can be fixed. With politics and energy, the problems are not nearly as complicated as putting a man on the moon. In each case, the core issues are corruption. Those who have arranged things for their own profit have all the motivation in the world to keep things just as they are. More on that a little later in our show. And now, our update from New York. In the Ada L. Smith case, senator for Queens from New York, we had a call from one of the Senator Smith's battered office workers telling us that subpoenas are now out for the grand jury. So the case against Smith is going forward. You may remember that we have been following this case for quite a while now, and that Smith has battered and vilified a growing number of her office workers over the years. Now, one would think that this would have denied her the support of the Democratic Party in New York, but no. Instead, they have worked tirelessly to clear the slate of competition for Smith so that she can return to office this November. Being a member of their exclusive little club makes Ms. Smith, as was true in the classical Animal Farm, more equal than the other pigs. This evidently holds for all the members of the legislature in New York and elsewhere, of course. And now our thoughts for the week ahead. In Texas's 22nd district, the former seat of Tom DeLay, a status quo Democrat faces off with a write-in Republican. The Libertarian, Bob Smither, is the one candidate who will raise the issue of the superhighway that both major parties want to see divide America down the middle. Eminent domain proceedings will take land by the football field and are making this the hottest issue on the horizon for Texans. The lack of difference between the opposing candidates in congressional races is one of the reasons that today longtime Republicans and Democrats are re-registering Refuse the State and Independent all over the country. Never in a century has the political balance been more fluid. Anything can happen. The September surprises from the White House may be followed by a November surprise for them, if the elections are honest. This week on The Spiritual Politician, we're going to be hearing from Bob Fitrakis, the Green Party candidate for governor in Ohio. Running as a candidate for a third party comes with real frustrations. If you've never been involved in third party politics, you may not appreciate how it is to be a second class citizen. You watch the Republican and Democratic Party candidates asked to participate in debates. You see them seriously considered for the endorsement of local papers. You hear their ideas taken seriously, while your own ideas are ignored until those ideas are grabbed by the same major party candidates. Ironically enough, many of the ideas now espoused by candidates from both the Republican and Democratic parties were originally voiced by either Green Party candidates or by Libertarian candidates. Third parties have traditionally been the pressure cooker that provides the future through ideas that have passed through the fire of debate. Most of the ideas you accept today are just common sense. In fact, were radical and unthinkable not so very long ago. Ideas are the tools your mind uses to assemble the world you live in. Sharing ideas builds a common home for humanity. Over time, many ideas change, but some ideas remain pretty much the same. We change our views on things like the Pledge of Allegiance, an idea that was actually originated by those we now know as progressives. Now liberals or progressives question the validity of pledging allegiance to an icon. When the idea was first adopted, many Christians and conservatives objected because, for Christians, pledging loyalty to a symbol was seen as the same as worshiping the golden calf. For the conservatives of the late 1800s, the idea of substituting a pledge for the study in school of America's founding documents was highly questionable. They believed that only an informed citizenry could guarantee a free nation. Questions were raised, but that is what happened. Remember that when you raise your hand to pledge, because the founders knew you needed to know the full content and significance of the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Federalist Papers to choose for yourself. Informed consent is essential for any action to be honorable and just. No matter what, we need to question what we think we know, because if we take the time to dig it out, we find the truth. And nothing makes us more powerful than knowing the truth before we take action. All of us have watched with growing dismay as the electoral process has been manipulated to elect when the people have voted otherwise. I first encountered this as a Republican when I was managing a campaign in the San Fernando Valley in the 1980s. Then the dirty tricks were carried out by Democrats, and the Berman-Waxman machine was still in control in Los Angeles. But now they have real competition. In 2004, we saw new heights of corruption take place in Ohio. And recently, we've heard murmurings of corruption in things like the initiative process, a tool originated by populists in the late 1800s to help the politically powerless fight back against the entrenched control of those in office. Tonight we're going to explore what has happened to politics in America and what is happening in Ohio in the aftermath of the 2004 election as 2006 election looms. As Americans, we'll all be making choices as people who are also connected to the sacred through our beliefs and through a reality that knows the whole truth. We need to look past labels and see what is happening to us, to America, and to the world. Our guest tonight is Bob Fitrakis. Along with being a candidate for governor in Ohio, Bob is a political science professor in the Social and Behavioral Sciences Department at Columbus State Community College, where he won the Distinguished Teaching Award in 1991. And he's written several books, including Did George W. Bush Steal America's 2004 Election? Essential Documents. Bob is also the executive director for the Columbus Institute for Contemporary Journalism and has published The Free Press since 1992. The Free Press website, www.freepress.org, is currently earning international attention for its coverage of the 2004 election irregularities in Ohio. Please welcome Bob Fitrakis. Bob, are you there?
I'm here.
Well, thanks for being with us this evening, Bob. And we always start by asking our guest to share something about himself. So tell us about you. Tell us about Bob.
I was born in Detroit, Michigan, back in 1955. And actually, my dad was a first-generation Greek-American who married a non-Greek woman. And the odd part about me is I was raised as a young child in a right-wing evangelical missionary church, Calvary United Missionary, which was a small sect that was going to go all over the world and save everyone. So a lot of my approach to politics tends to be a bit evangelical and kind of morally based crusades, although I no longer belong to the evangelical right, but I understand them because that's where I grew up.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, and you've been through a very interesting transition ideologically, too.
Well, in terms of ideology, I've been all over the place. I mean, when I was growing up, my church was very conservative, but I lived in Detroit, a very progressive, democratic city. While in junior high and high school, I identified with the politics of revolt in the late 60s, early 70s, particularly the then White Panthers Party, which John Sinclair and the MC5 were associated with.
The White Panthers Party?
Yeah, it was. They were the auxiliary of the Black Panthers.
I never knew that there was a White Panthers Party. Tell us about that.
Well, I don't know if it was so much a party. It appeared to be a bunch of guys that were in a rock band who, liked to smoke pot and hold rallies.
Well, it sounds like you had a good time.
Well, it was my high school and college years. So. And then, I've identified with everyone from the Yippies back in the 70s to various other movements, progressive social democratic movements. I've backed various third parties over the years, but by the late 1980s, I settled in as a Democrat before the party moved to the center and purged most of their progressive civil libertarian activists.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm an independent candidate for governor, and I'm endorsed by the Green Party. But the oddity is I also was offered the lieutenant governor's position by the Libertarian Party. If that tells you anything.
That is very interesting. You know that there's a candidate in Maryland, Kevin Zeese, who's been endorsed by the Greens and the Libertarians and the Populist Party, I think.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that had to do with my voting rights activism, because it was really the Greens and the Libertarians who did the recount in Ohio. And when the Democrats quickly folded their tent as the loyal opposition, it was the third parties that fought on for transparency.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the idea, I talked about it earlier, that it's really the third parties that are sort of percolating the ideas and where the movement is?
Well, I think by the nature of American politics, the congressional system where there's no, it's not a parliament, so it's hard to get third parties into government. It's not a proportional system. It's really geared towards two-state status quo parties. So by the very nature of it, the Democrats and the Republicans are going to, span the political spectrum from A to B and debate over the 3-5% of undecided voters in the middle, thus leaving almost all new ideas and innovation and debate in key policy matters to the Greens, Libertarians, and other third parties. And I think it's really been that way throughout U.S. history. Take, for example, the most successful third party in U.S. history, the Republican Party.
That's right.
Because the Whigs wouldn't deal with the issue of slavery. So, smaller parties, the abolitionist party, it used to be easy to have a third party at a state level. The Free Soil parties, formed into the broad coalition we now know as the Republican Party. And because they were willing to speak on the great moral issue of the day, they actually won the election in 1860.
What do you think about how fluid the political, people's political loyalties are right now? I have been amazed at how many people I've seen leave, say, the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, where they have been all of their lives, where their parents were, and they're re-registering.
Well, it's the last indicators I saw is there's now more people who call themselves independents than Democrats or Republicans, and I think that really has to do with the how far the country's swung to the right in an authoritarian way, and the fact that the Democrats, for the most part, have not shown themselves to be an oppositional party. In most democracies, you would have had a, you know, pro-war, anti-war, or pro-peace debate over the invasion of Iraq. You know, arguably, you know, the most atrocious war we've waged in many ways as a modern nation, and from my perspective, an illegal war. You know, mm-hmm. that if George W. Bush wasn't the president of the United States, he would be in the docket with Saddam or other war criminals.
Sounds good to me.
What?
Sounds good to me.
Well, no, I believe that. It's clear from the record that he and his neocon friends, you know, conspired, planned, and have waged aggressive war, which violates the principles of Nuremberg, which the Americans helped put into place after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for the Democrats, John Kerry, to stake out a position that we should have more troops in Iraq following an illegal invasion, that's really not a debate. I mean, in many ways, Bush was almost the progressive peace candidate because he wanted to stay the course. Kerry was arguing for more troops. And many people, you know, just don't tend to see it this way, but in many ways, the Democratic Party is more conservative than the conservative parties of Europe and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably the second most pro-corporate, and I mean corporate not in a small sense of closely held corporations, but in terms of these large multinationals that now roam the earth, is that, you know, it's almost a cliche that the, you know, wealthy, the wealthiest 1%, own the Republican Party, but they seem to have a long-term lease on the Democrats, particularly with the rise of, you know, the Democratic Leadership Council and Bill Clinton.
Yes, I have to say that I was very disappointed that the Democratic Party didn't do something that actually, you know, could at least address the problem. And I've been shocked at how many people, Democrats in Congress, have failed to endorse the Conyers bill.
Well, not only the Conyers bill, I mean, when somebody steps forward with courage like Senator Feingold, I mean, essentially they flee in terror. And at least there'd be a debate on the president's illegal war or a variety of issues, you know. I mean, very few people. I mean, John Conyers is to be greatly commended. But, you know, very few people in the Democratic Party were willing to speak out strongly against torture. I mean, it's really someone of my generation who grew up, you know, after World War II and was indoctrinated to America's greatness. To think that, you know, we would have a sitting regime that advocated and embraced torture and tried to redefine it and say, well, it's not really torture unless a major body organ fails is absurd. I mean, the fact that you would have the largest spy apparatus in the world in the United States, a country that was founded on principles of liberty and talked about inalienable rights, the fact that we would even be debating, you know, spying on American citizens without probable cause in a warrant really is stunning to me as a PhD in political science. And the fact that we would now be waging preventative war, not preemptive war, Iraq was no threat to us, but essentially removing leaders through invading them in illegal, old-fashioned occupation is really, in many ways, a throwback to 19th century imperialism, and it goes against the founding principles of this country, which, you know, fought the real first anti-imperialist modern war.
Yes, that's so true. And it's also true about the present paradigm that it's imperialist, but it's trying to use a rhetoric of freedom and fear in a way that I don't know if that's been done before, has it? Have they used fear this way?
Yeah, I think if we look back at history and really look at propaganda, I mean, I think there are parallels clearly in, you know, Benito Mussolini and his, you know, war on drugs and his whole merger of, you know, the corporate order with the state and the military-industrial complex. I think you clearly saw the great personification of fear-mongering in Nazi Germany. I think, you know, Stalin's Russia played on the fear of the people as well. So most authoritarian regimes, particularly the very successful ones, have kept people off balance in constant states of fear. You know, that's why you had Tom Ridge, after he left Homeland Security, suggesting that many of those Homeland Security alerts in the 2004 election year were probably politically motivated.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it should be any real surprise that suddenly airplanes are being diverted, as we come close to the election, in most of these in hysterical acts. And also, of course, earlier, suddenly we've discovered there's immigrants in the country. This is after the Republican policy of NAFTA, sold by Bill Clinton, when the K Street International Trade crowd couldn't get it through with Reagan and Bush, essentially opened up our borders. Suddenly we're finding that this is a great threat. It's clearly politically motivated, and this happens in connections to election. These are these so-called wedge issues where they don't want people thinking, getting together, thinking rationally about their self-interest. They don't want people creating, sustainable local economies and moving towards forms of entrepreneurship and getting off the energy grid. Instead, what they want to do is scare people. And in Ohio in 2004, that was Ken Blackwell, right? It's what if gay people marry? What if people are living in domestic partnerships? And, the reality is most people, a lot of the vote against, it was already illegal for gay people to be married in Ohio. And instead, they changed the Constitution so they'd have even more protection. But most of the vote came from areas where there's no openly gay institutions. Adams County, Warren County, Ohio, these rural little places where you won't find one openly, gay person or openly gay bar. So I always wonder, why would they worry about there might be some gay people in Columbus or Cleveland or Cincinnati where they never set foot?
Well, it seems to me what they've done with issues like gays is they've tried to create this boogeyman that somehow is, this is the threat, this is the threat. It isn't what we're doing behind your back, picking your pocket. It's this thing over here. And you see that with what I call the rapture Republicans.
Oh, so sure.
The megachurches.
Well, I'm not a Marxist. I did read, as I read all the great theorists from Adam Smith to Karl Marx, but perhaps a few things that left in that legacy is the use of religion as the opiate of the masses, or as I think a metaphor he once said, like it's like a balloon. So you hold a balloon up in the sky and everyone looks up, then you pick their pocket. So what really seems to have happened, and I wrote a little about this in a book I wrote called The Idea of Democratic Socialism and the Decline of the American Socialist Party, which was a lament in many ways, criticizing the modern democratic socialists as too intellectual, too into identity politics, and not like some of the great socialist leaders like Eugene Victor Debs, who were very, very civil libertarian, very anti-statist, and very populist, and also had tremendous ties to the indigenous people and the way they saw politics. But what's really happened, I think with World War I, a lot of the progressive, independent religious folks were really squashed during the original Red Scare. Their papers were destroyed. They were in prison. Debs went to jail for 10 years for uttering those immortal words in Canton, Ohio. He suggested the rich have always declared war and poor and working people have always fought and died.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went to jail in part because he refused to take back a single word. The transcripts of that famous trial in Cleveland, which was really America's first Socratic trial, I like to reread those at least once a year, because one of the lines he said is, I swear to every word that I said, I meant it. And not only that, I wouldn't gag the lips of my bitterest enemy because I would destroy freedom. So what you're really having coming out of the 20s is kind of a merger between right-wing evangelical religion and nationalism. And you were so right on during your early marks where, what you've got now is a new golden calf,
mm-hmm.
sort of a critical critical portion of the population being attacked by uncritical forces that have adopted sort of a mindless nationalism, not a patriotism that reflects on our values and tries to live up to freedom, but really is into ritualism and rote reciting and unquestioning acceptance of authority, even when that authority appears to be misguided, or in the case of our current president, you know, appears to be of a low IQ nature, even though he has, I mean, on one basic level, right? I mean, all of us know that, you know, if it wasn't real, we would think Jethro Bodine was president.
Well, that's certainly true. I got a question. You raise an interesting point, because it's never looked to me more like there was more potential for real coalition between the right and the left than there is right now. And what you've just enunciated is so true. I talk to libertarians on the, you know, all the way across the spectrum, and progressives and liberals, and they say pretty much the same thing. And it seems to me there is a very common American basis for a coalition that subsumes both viewpoints, because there really are just one viewpoint.
Right, because you have this large, massive authoritarian bloc of, you know, neocon corporate capitalists, sort of globalists. And on the other hand, you've got, you know, a sort of an agreement among the Greens and the Libertarian that you need, you know, entrepreneurship, more sustainable, localized economies. You need an end to the prison industrial complex, that the war on drugs is ridiculous and absurd, and you know, why can't we grow hemp? You can't get high off it, but it surely makes a lot of interesting and good products, from food to fiber to paper.
Really
good
oil,
too. And good for the economy. And also that an agreement, I think, among the libertarians and Greens that the and independents and populists that, you know, the United States shouldn't have the third largest equivalent of a military budget, but it's really used to spy on its own citizens. That this security industrial complex needs to be shattered.
Well, it seemed to me for a long time that if we were going to have people in Iraq, given what they're actually why they're actually there, they should be wearing uniforms issued by the petroleum companies.
Well, you know, I think that's truth in advertising.
Yes, absolutely, and I think we need to go back there so people understand exactly what's going on, because you know, the petroleum companies and the other large corporations have come to view the assets and the resources of America as an extension of their own corporate resources.
Sure, and that was inevitable. As the as these corporations under the New Jersey Charter were no longer controlled, thus making it difficult for older forms of businesses, and here I speak of the proprietor or, you know, the general partnership or closely held private corporations that had to compete in localized markets and adhere to some principles of localized morality and value. As these massive, massive soulless entities began to roam the planet and accumulate so much money, inevitably they, you know, felt that the government should be their appendage, that the government was just another asset to be bought up and used. And if that means a hostile takeover of another nation, what difference is it than a hostile takeover of another large corporation? I mean, fundamentally, they don't believe in competition. They don't want to trade with people and influence people in that nonviolent way. They would just as soon do a hostile takeover. So Iraq, in many ways, is just one giant corporate hostile takeover of another entity to rip off the resources.
Right, and of course, it probably wouldn't have happened at all when it did if it wasn't for the fact that Iraq had just made an agreement to sell oil to France and Russia, and they had thought they'd moved to the euro.
Right, they were moving away from the petrodollar, sure.
Mm-hmm. And of course, to make one of these things work, you have to find the people who are willing to do whatever it takes to make it work. And you've got one of those people in your own state who's been very, very valuable to the neocons, and that's, of course, Ken Blackwell. and he is he's the person you're running against in your race for governor.
Yeah, J. Kenneth Blackwell, who we like to say gave opportunism a bad way. He's sort of spun across the political spectrum, transforming himself from a black nationalist as the former head of the Black Student Union at Xavier, who invited in the Black Panther, to a left-wing charter Democrat in Cincinnati, to a liberal Democrat, to a moderate Democrat, to a independent, to a moderate Republican, to a conservative Republican, and now to, Ohio's leading Christo-fascist.
Mm-hmm. A Christo-fascist, I haven't heard that term before.
Well, or as we, some people used to call them the Shiite Republicans.
I like that. That's cute. He has a very interesting history. And now he's running for governor, and he's been moving toward a more prominent position amongst the neocon cadre for a long time now. And he actually has some other interesting contacts, doesn't he?
Oh, sure. If you go back and take a look at what is publicly available, Mr. Blackwell's been groomed for a long period of time, including his role on the advisory board of the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, which I like to call the AAA team to the American Enterprise Institute.
Mm-hmm.
It's an institute that believes in regime change. I mean, that's what they spell out in their own literature. In fact, let me quote from him. I hate to be unfair to him, but JINSA supports regime change in nation states known to provide support or knowingly harbor terrorist groups. So they targeted Iraq, Iran, Syria, Lebanon, and Libya, saying that the U.S. should forcibly remove their governments.
And, of course, it's a curious coincidence that it always seems to be places where there's a lot of oil. I know it must just be a coincidence. Right?
It's like never regime change in Sudan or Darfur, or regime change in Rwanda, where massive genocide go on, you don't get much talk about regime change, or no regime change in the Saudi government in Saudi Arabia, even though it's one of the most regressive on earth.
Yes. Well, there is that interesting coincidence, which would lead most people to think perhaps if you followed the money, you would get a very different story than they tell. But Blackwell.
Yeah, I think a rogue nation. I was trying to figure out what a rogue nation was, but the best I could come up with was a nation that wouldn't allow McDonald's in.
That's a rogue nation. And, of course, it looks like we actually may take action in India because of the Coca-Cola issue.
Yeah.
We're not supposed to. Did that remind you of the Opium Wars?
Oh, in many ways. It's, a different form of drug, although it was at one time the real thing. And some people would argue, actually, when cocaine and opium laudanum was in liquid forms and less concentrated, we had less problems. And when the government came in and regulated, given rise to heroin and even harsher drugs. But I think, American corporate interest, Smedley D. Butler's famous quote about how he'd been a bully boy for Wall Street and, how he'd been a gangster for capitalism and citing which countries he had invaded for which corporate interest, I think it's well worth remembering that we've had a long history of these type of occupations and takeovers based on serving the interest of a few corporations.
Mm-hmm. It's a way for the corporations to make sure they keep the needles in and they can keep sucking our blood out.
Yeah, and a lot of that, too, is they got to keep you on the grid, right?
Absolutely.
Is that they've got to buy up all the patents for alternative energy. They've got to convince you that you can't have a sort of a cooperative, volunteer, neighborhood power system, and that they're able in many ways to define what reality is and scare people into heavy consumption and dependence on their energy sources.
Mm-hmm. And especially in Ohio and in other states, these people have done everything they could to ensure that they kept sort of an electoral grasp on the process so that they could guarantee that they would be in the position to keep pumping our blood out?
Well, you know, I mean, they just flat out stole the election here in 2004, and then, you know, you steal it, and then you create propaganda. You know, but they did it with the help of the Democratic Party, is why, you know, I'm running as an independent endorsed by the Greens. It's, the Democrats didn't do the recount in this state. Again, it was the Libertarians and the Greens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Republicans will just lie and say nothing happened. I think J. Kenneth Blackwell called it a model election. But the question is, a model for what? You know, which dictator are we talking about in world history? You know, was it Stalin? Was it, you know, Sukarto? Who exactly?
Yes. What do you think is going to happen there in the election this year? Is it going to be more honest, or is it?
No, I think they're going to keep stealing. I mean, they're like an alcoholic. Until there's a crisis intervention by the people, because it ain't coming from the Democrats. The Democrats are in denial, or in some cases, you know, their incumbents are benefiting from the same non-transparent machines.
What kind of techniques are you using to try to make sure that it isn't stolen, though? Have you put together some protocols?
Yeah, I mean, we're in the process of gathering the names of all these private technicians. I mean, the fact that we're counting our votes on partisan corporate machines using proprietary, you know, non-transparent secret software is in and of itself just a stunning, you know, attack upon democracy, which belongs to the people. And when we have pen and paper, all we need is a transparent locked ballot boxes, and you fold it and put it in, and you let everyone in when they're counted. The officials count it in front of all parties,
mm-hmm.
in front of the media.
Well, that's
in front
what it
of the
used to
community.
Be. It's still like that in New Hampshire.
And we should follow that model. It worked quite well. I mean, you know, that really, I like to think in many ways that which was done covertly in the Third World has been brought home. And once people understand that idea, that democracy is being subverted, what they want is what the CIA used to call, on the record, demonstration elections, right? It's you're creating these elections not for the will of the people, but to simply create legitimacy for a regime that you favor. And that the only way around that, I mean, it's just, unacceptable that private partisan e-voting machines, some with remote access, with private technicians, and we don't know who they are, would be programming the hardware or the software. And part of what we're doing is trying to get the names of all these mysterious people who show up on election day and, you know, tweak the central tabulators and come out with the results. I think they're going to keep stealing. You know, they're kleptomaniacs. It's, in many ways, it's not a democracy. You know, it's not ruled by the people. It's not a plutocracy, even ruled by the rich. It's really come down to kleptocracy, and that is ruled by thieves.
Well, they need the thieves to steal it so they can keep stealing. It isn't the elections that pay. It's what Mencken say, elections are futures markets, stolen property. It's so true.
No, it is. And part of the game, and both parties have begun to play this, is that politics is about, you know, taking your power and turning it into assets or money, and taking that money and turning it into more power.
Mm-hmm.
It has very little to do with values or morality. It really is, in many ways, the triumph first of Machiavelli, you know, who told the prince to be the first one out with public demonstrations of, you know, religious sentiment, but not to take real religion or value seriously. It's the triumph of the Straussians like Paul Wolfowitz, who have the same approach that somehow they're special and extraordinary, and it's their obligation as virtuous, willful men to essentially impose whatever world order they want on the general mass of the unwashed that are, you know, not as smart as them.
Well, it sounds like something they probably picked up in preschool, and then nobody ever broke them of.
Well, you know, in many ways, you're right. They did pick it up early on, and, you know, it's sort of just a continuation of stealing people's lunch money.
It's exactly so.
And in this case, though, most of these guys are wimps, chicken hawks, and, you know, what they do is rent bullies as needed.
And they certainly have the money to do that. I've always thought that Karl Rove must have worn out several copies of The Prince.
Oh, well, he publicly admits to reading it every year, right? It's a primer. And he goes back to the Nixon White House and the dirty tricks with Donald Segretti. He was written up in the Washington Post. And he uses people like J. Kenneth Blackwell in Ohio, or as we like to say, the J is for Judas.
Oh, yes, but now we have, of course, the testament of Judas, so Judas probably wasn't a bad guy.
Right, now we're now getting a little revisionism that, we may owe an apology to Judas to compare him to someone of J. Kenneth Blackwell's Machiavellian tendency.
When do you think that the neocons actually recruited Blackwell? If you take a look at his history, he was definitely in contact with them very early.
I think you get a key shift around 1989 when he becomes deputy undersecretary of the Department of Housing and Urban Development.
Under Bush Sr.
Sure, and I think the key shift where his ties come out in 1991 when he's appointed by President George Bush to the U.S. Ambassador at the United Nations Human Rights Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from there you see him begin to go into a lot of other areas. Generally, by the end of the 1990s, he's clearly a neocon, and he's on a variety of boards tied to these people.
And he's sort of on their little escalator because they're going to move him up. They're going to use him in various ways, and he's completely on board.
Oh, they're already talking about him as a vice presidential candidate, and he hasn't even, you know, he's got 27% of the vote in the polls now. So, you know, there are so few blacks in the Republican Party. They really, their strategy is to use the religious issue to peel off, you know, 30-40% of the black vote around the issues of black pride and black nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with Blackwell is that while he quotes Martin Luther King, I mean, the reality is, you know, he's really, you know, wants to be the leader of a Bush Bantustan called Ohio.
Well, and that makes perfect sense for him because it's made him a wealthy man. How else? He couldn't have gotten it, honestly.
No, neither. You know, he ends up being a multimillionaire because of his blue chip company, which has, you know, ties to very powerful people like Carl Lidner and other factors. So, you know, he's a very rich man, and, you know, he saw his opportunities, and he took them.
And he's on the board for a whole list of other groups, including Citizens for Tax Reform, the Club for Growth, and Social Security Choice, right?
Yeah, and he recently wrote a book, and he's pushing a lot of their programs. I think the most interesting is he wants the privatization of water, which, as you know, may have caused problems in Bolivia. And, you know, he wants to privatize the turnpike. But a lot of the games, they really don't want to privatize these things. They want to privatize them and rip off the assets, and then they want to sell them back, and then they want to reprivatize them.
Now, where they got this idea was actually through Cato, because what you do is you take whatever it is, you use the term privatization, you decouple the profit and the accountability, and you take the profit and you give the accountability to somebody else.
Sure, yeah, because in many ways it's like the savings and loan scandal, right?
Mm-hmm.
The taxpayers get all the obligation to pay off, and the few people get the right to loot all the assets.
That's right, and that certainly makes sense from their point of view, and because they're optimizing their profit, and at a time in American history when we're looking down a well into a depression that is, you know, greater than any that we've ever seen.
Sure, $9 trillion in known debt, all sorts of off-the-book debt. It's really hard to believe that they've taken one of the wealthiest societies in all of human history and they pretty much looted it.
Mm-hmm. And they've used all of our virtues, our trust, our ability to you know, render us poverty stricken.
Oh yeah, and in many ways, it's they've turned us into, you know, a gangster nation that will impose its will to rip off other people's resources. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's that whole game of, you know, what's, you know, the baby Jesus's oil doing under a rocky soil.
That's right. You know, I always think that there's a little target on the map on all the places in the globe where there's oil or there may be oil, and that we're going there. We have
right,
a reason.
And instead of unleashing the genius of the American inventors and entrepreneurs to provide all sorts of new forms of energy,
mm-hmm.
you know, they want to make sure we're dependent on a non-renewable source which a handful of people control.
It is such a strange, it must be such a strange mindset to be them. It's hard to even imagine.
Yeah, I think they just understand the limited parameters, right? It's about making money, and if it means hijacking whole companies and unbid contracts, and yeah, you know, in many ways, it's, you know, it's a chess game, and you know, when Zygmunt Brzezinski writes about the grand chessboard, it's like something the masses can't really contemplate, and that's not Democrats, you know, small d, because fundamentally they don't trust people. They don't trust the marketplace of ideas. They don't trust localized markets. All they understand is a command-control economy and a command-control world run through authoritarians.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly true, and you can see it about everything that they are. They want to own everything. They don't trust anybody to run their own lives. And I don't know if it's so much trust. They don't see a profit there for themselves if somebody runs their own.
Right. You're really turning people into consumers and commodities, right? And then you create a prison industrial complex to some extent, not because we, you know, need to lock up three times as many people as the 1970s, but because there's contracts involved in running the prisons. So in a place like Ohio, you know, prisoners used to grow their own corn, their own wheat, their own food, have their own dairy cows, you know, make their own cheese. And in the new world, right, is, you know, all they can do is lift weights, and then some contractor who's cut a huge check to a politician gets to get an unbid contract to deliver these services that the prisoners historically produce for themselves.
Mm-hmm. I want you to imagine for a moment a different scenario. Imagine this world and then superimpose on that a world where you get people can actually walk over and turn off the spigots so it sputters and all of a sudden the money stops flowing to those corporations. What happens to them politically?
You mean to the people or the corporations?
To the corporations.
Well, the corporations really are artificial entities that we created through these corporate charters. I think they, like any other species that is too bloated and too large and cumbersome to survive, is they'll do what the evolution provides for them. They'll shrink, become more adaptable. They'll break in and splinter into a variety of corporations, and they'll unleash some of their vestiges of entrepreneurship and competitiveness in the local markets, and the world will be a much better place.
Yes. Now, what happens if they're actually held accountable? Because at that point, they don't no longer can control.
Well, if we hold them accountable, we're going to have, you know, war crimes and criminal trials for the next 100 years. I mean,
well, they'd probably be dead before then, but, you know, we could be more efficient about it. That could happen.
Yeah. I think part of it. Just like in the third world where you had to have truth commissions, I think we need to come clean as to what crimes were committed by these large corporations, what crimes were committed by the neocons and our president. And that's a cathartic purging, is that you don't take a step forward until you acknowledge the crimes you've committed against other people.
And that's one of the things that's never unfortunately happened, all the way back from the robber barons. They were allowed, even though everybody knew what they had done, they were allowed to buy their way back in to people's good graces because they donated. And that was a mistake.
Well, yeah, philanthropy. I mean, this we'll call El Capone's Soup Kitchen.
That's right.
Right. Generally you use philanthropy. If you steal a lot of money and then you give some of it, a small amount of it back under philanthropy or to charity, somehow you're considered reputable.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, we have a sense of what you think is going to happen in Ohio. What do you think is going to happen in the rest of the country? I know that there were six states where they're pretty sure that the neocons are going to be stealing the elections.
Well, you know, I think like Iraq, they don't have an exit strategy. I mean, literally, they do not have an exit strategy from leaving power in Congress and leaving the White House.
Well, we don't have one for Iraq either, so.
Yeah, I mean, and they're afraid of exiting because I think they realize that if someone like John Conyers has subpoena power, is that a lot of people are going to end up going to jail. So I think that what they're going to do is continue to steal the election through the corporate, non-transparent e-voting machines. And the other thing is to shrink the electorate.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is to make it so difficult for urban people and poor people and minorities to vote that you would just hope to win a slight majority of the 50% or less of the population that will vote. So, you know, in many ways, we might only have in an off-year election usually about a 36% voter turnout. So I think they understand here in Ohio, they're putting all sorts of restrictions in place, new, you know, photo IDs, but they're not really telling anyone, and they're throwing people off the ballot who haven't voted in the last two federal elections, and they really don't tell them. So what they really do is they hope they get 50% plus one of that 36%, you know, 18% of the vote plus one vote to keep control and power.
You know what? I would bet on the American people.
You know, I would too, and it really looks like the bottom is falling out because of the war and because of, you know, the people's distaste for President Bush. And 92% of the population left Zogby's poll want full transparency. But at a certain point, I think Al Gore said it right, and there's a lot of times Al Gore, you know, was very gutless in the year 2000 following the election. But he said there isn't much space in the U.S. between a stolen election and picking up the gun. I mean, there aren't a whole lot of alternatives in many cases.
And that's something
But one is what they did in Mexico, right? One is kind of not standing down and making the system ungovernable till real democratic elections occur.
And I think that we're staring that right in the face. Well, I
want to
thank
so
you
too,
for,
and I don't fear that.
I want to thank you for being with us today, and I don't think any of us really need to be afraid of anything except our government. And I really want to thank you for the work you're doing, and I want to tell you I always enjoy free press when I get it, and I hope everybody goes and signs up so that they get it too. And on behalf of all Americans who care about honesty in government, I hope that you keep doing the same thing, and no matter what the chances look like, I hope that you're the next governor of Ohio.
Well, and it'll become a Bill of Rights enforcement zone, and again, I pledge to create a constitutional crisis by ordering the Ohio National Guard to stand down and not be deployed to Iraq. I think it's overdue. We've got to escalate the battle over just and unjust wars. And people can check out my site at bobforohio.com or at thefreepress.org. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Okay.
God bless.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today, Friday, August 25th, 2006. Here at The Spiritual Politician, we're working to show that government is just a tool, sometimes simple, sometimes complex, but just a tool we use to do the work we need done. It's up to us, the people, to decide how we organize our communities, and we need to use persuasion, never deceit, coercion, or violence. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and their happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate the governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom, and may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.